It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about a lost city that exists in UW-Madison's Arboretum. That's in today's installment of Curious Wisconsin.
First, the U.S. Senate has officially gone nuclear. Earlier today, Democrats pushed through rules changes to the filibuster for certain presidential appointees.
This so-called nuclear option has been brought up in the past, but never acted on until today. Some are calling it a momentous step for a Senate that's often slow to change. Others are saying it's politically risky and could come back to bite the Democrats.
Joining us now to explain what happened is Gregory Koger. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. Gregory, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So Democrats in the Senate have talked about doing this before, and at one point I believe Republicans did too, but why did it happen today?
Well, I think this is a culmination of a long process. As you mentioned, so the Republicans in 2003 to 2005 actually had a similar problem. The minority party was blocking their judicial nominees, and they eventually came up with a compromise. Over the last 3 years, oh, I'm sorry, 5 years, the Democrats have also been frustrated by the minority party and have sought reforms. But in the past, they've settled for, sort of minor incremental reforms or promises of good behavior or, getting that one thing that they wanted released, like a one nomination or one bill. So I think today's actions are very much the culmination of that process and like the culmination of all the frustration the Democrats have felt over the last 5 years, because there wasn't a lot of warning. So this wasn't like an attempt to sort of cow the Republicans into backing down on, these three nominations for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. It was, I think, really the decision that they were no longer going to play this game. And even if they had gotten the three nominations that they were fighting for today, I think the Democrats still would have, been sufficiently frustrated by everything that's occurred up to this point, but that they would have still wanted to go ahead and change the way the Senate works.
So under the new system, they can approve appointees with a majority, a simple majority. Who would this change apply to? Who would it not apply to?
It applies to all executive nominations. That means cabinet secretaries, lower-level executive branch nominations. And it also applies to federal district court judges and appellate court judges. So the only thing that's left, the only nominations that are still susceptible to a filibuster are Supreme Court nominations.
Republicans not happy about this happening. What kind of reaction have you seen from them so far?
The main talking point I've heard, well, two talking points. One is that they point out accurately that what today's actions exposes is that the rules of the Senate mean what a simple majority of the Senate say that they mean. And in that sense, it's a game in which the minority has no rights that can't be taken away. I think that's true. I think it was true yesterday, though. I mean, it's always been the case that the majority has this power. And so it has always been the case that the minority party should use its prerogatives in a way that the majority party will accept. And they have not done so. The current minority party has not done so in recent years.
On a wider perspective, a kind of a pro-con, there's been criticism of the Senate that it's slow, it's hard to get things done because of the filibuster rule. On the other hand, people say that's a good thing. It prevents a majority from running roughshod just because they've got 51 to R49. Do you have a feeling, good or bad, on this?
Yeah, I mean, in the context of the broader debate, I've been sort of a moderate. Like, I actually do appreciate the value of filibustering in terms of it's a mechanism for preserving real debate in the Senate, which doesn't occur in the House. And it is a way to, moderate legislation as it's moving through the House. I think there are two. But the other side of the argument is also quite strong. One is, which is, if you're using the power to obstruct just to tie up the Senate, just to keep anything from happening, just to slow everything down as much as possible to run out the clock, Then I think that senators who are doing that are abusing the privilege in a way that doesn't advance the collective interests of the United States. And the other thing is similarly, if it's just a tool of political party, if it's just a way to keep the other party from passing their agenda, from passing things that are popular or that would, you know, improve the country, because you don't want them to accumulate a record of accomplishments, then also I don't think that the power to obstruct is serving the greater interests of the country.
Congress hasn't been noteworthy for bipartisan collaboration and collegiality lately. Does this make that even worse?
Probably. I mean, yes, almost certainly, right? The Senate Republicans can now and will now loudly say that the majority has gotten drunk with power. They're stealing the classic prerogatives of the minority party in the Senate. They will say these things. And they'll probably feel them quite sincerely and act on that feeling. So, yes, in the short term, I do expect there'll be a little less comity in the Senate than we were observing. But that's a pretty low baseline, so I don't know how much we will miss as a consequence.
Mitch McConnell points out, hey, a couple years, maybe we run the place, and what you just did pays off for us. Do you think Democrats may regret this in 2 or 4 years?
It's entirely possible. I mean, again, my argument is that it's always been possible for this to happen, but certainly today's actions makes that explicit to everybody. And so, yes, it is entirely possible that, you know, in 2017, if there's a Republican president and Republican majorities in the House and Senate, that they might then say, well, remember when you did this thing and now we're going to just we're going to do even more and eliminate all filibusters on legislation so we can get our agenda through as fast as possible. That is possible. And Democrats right now might anticipate that possibility and say, why should we allow filibusters against legislation now if in the future that right will be taken away from us? So we might as well just get rid of it now.
So the clock's ticking. We might lose control of the Senate. Let's pass as much as we can and just forget that whole filibuster thing as much as we can.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think the fact that the House of Representatives has a majority of the Republican Party does sort of take away the incentive to eliminate legislative filibustering, because even if the Senate Democrats could get their legislation through the Senate exactly how they want it, it still would just end up sitting at the desk in the House of Representatives. So,
thinking about the long-term historical perspective here, is it wise to make a fundamental procedural change in response to this current crisis? Shouldn't we do this thing in a more deliberative fashion, away from the hurly-burly of daily politics?
No. I mean, I think when the senators observe that their rules just don't work, and they sincerely feel like the interests of the Senate, the interests of the nation would be better served by changing the rules, they should do it then. I mean, the other side of the argument is, oh, we should wait until the beginning of a new Congress. But the problem then is that when you're enacting reforms, you're doing so in anticipation of bad behavior by the other side. And so it's always hard to know exactly how far you ought to go. Like if you knew in January 2009 that the Republicans would fight every comma of the Democratic agenda, then maybe Democratic senators might have been a little bit more ambitious in changing the rules of the Senate then, but they didn't know. And so if your argument is, you know, the only legitimate time to change the rules is at the beginning of a Congress, then you're sort of giving license to bad behavior by everybody else for the next 2 years, and then you don't solve the problem until long after it's been festering.
All right, Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gregory Koger. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami.
Coming up next, we travel to Wisconsin's Lost City and find out about a neighborhood that never was.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's one of those places you hear rumors about, the lost city of the UW Arboretum in Madison. You might wonder, what's there and how did it get lost?
Today, in our Curious Wisconsin installment, we'll find out. Kathy Miner joins us. She's an Arboretum naturalist and guide. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the Lost City?
Well, the Lost City, its official name was Lake Forest, and it was going to be a grand and elegant suburb running basically between Lake Wingra and Fish Hatchery Road. Covers quite a bit of land, which is now the Arboretum.
And how extensive is it?
840 acres is the number we're given, which is, if you think about it, about two-thirds of the present Arboretum, because our size is 1260 or so. So about a little over 1 square mile, maybe 1.3 square miles.
So why was this never finished?
Well, there were a variety of reasons, some having to do with the land and some having to do with people and some having to do with politics. And the part that had to do with the land was that they were building on swampland. And though they did some homework, the developers, about how much fill they would need and what they would need to remediate, they miscalculated or underestimated. And so they didn't use enough fill, and roads literally sank, became covered with water. But the another big piece of it was that the bond company that was underwriting the Lake Forest Land Company, the operator of that bond company, was involved in fraud. He'd been in real estate fraud in Chicago before he came to Madison, unbeknownst to the Lake Forest developers. And when he left Madison, he engaged in some fraud out on the East Coast. So the bond company went under. The money had been used for other things. And so that was a big problem. And then the third piece of it was that because the Lake Forest Land Company operated between 1911 and 1922, World War I came along and drastically affected the national economy.
Now, you've actually been to this lost city. What does it look like if you stumble on it today?
Well, it's interesting. It would be possible to walk back there and not really know. Nature is taking the concrete paving back little by little. There are places where you can see concrete edges and you know you must be walking on an old road. But there are other places where they're really, really well hidden and you'd have to scrape away quite a bit of dirt or leaf duff before you would see any evidence.
And can you see it? Have people done flyovers and gotten aerial shots? Does it kind of stand out when you look at it from above?
It doesn't stand out. It wouldn't stand out anymore. Mm. There are aerial photographs done. We have one from 1937, and I believe there was one in the early 1950s. And, of course, now we have satellite photographs. But at this point, the forest is dense enough, and the undergrowth in particular is dense enough that you might never know. But there are a couple of crumbling foundations in the middle of the woods. And if you know where to find them, you can see concrete, moss-covered concrete front steps and remains of foundations.
Now, why wouldn't the Arboretum have removed that stuff? They know it's there. It's not what nature intended. Why is it still there?
Well, there were a half a dozen houses built between the present-day Martin and Carver streets on the side streets that go between them, and those are still standing and surrounded by much newer homes, and so, of course, that is still a residential area. But I think it was probably a matter of expense, of just simply not having the money or the labor available to tear up the old pavement and do the kind of remediation that would have been needed.
So when you're taking people on a tour of the Arboretum, along with the nature, is the Lost City part of the tour?
Once a year, we do a tour of the Lost City. It's always on the Sunday closest to Halloween. We make that association between the mysterious Lost City and possibly hauntings. And so it is on the last Sunday in October. And we start with a slideshow indoors with some photographs and some history of the thing, and then we go out and hike to it, and we find the pavement edges as we come across them. And then just that once, we do take people off our regulation trails, and we bushwhack around through the woods to find one in particular of the crumbling foundations. I have to say here that we really don't want to encourage people to be wandering around back there for their own safety and for the sake of the wildlife and the ecosystem that's back there. But once a year, we do sanction it, and it's really quite interesting. Lots of people show up. It's a very intriguing topic.
Now, you mentioned hauntings. Are there actual reports of hauntings at the Lost City?
I've actually heard of stories of hauntings and mysterious noises in some of the other wooded areas of the Arboretum. I'm not aware of any in there, but I will tell you that I was, before I started doing giving the tours of the Lost City area. I was back there once by myself doing some scouting, and it happened to be approaching sunset. And I was standing at this crumbling foundation and front steps, and a great horned owl began to hoot from quite nearby. And I didn't stick around a whole lot longer after that.
not a literal haunting, but a haunting sound.
Exactly,
anyway.
Yes.
So when I think of a name like Lost City, I want to picture an amateur Indiana Jones exploring around there. Do archaeologists or do local historians go in and try to find relics of the Lost City?
There is some interest, and actually we recently rediscovered another one of the foundations, and there are a few areas where there are kind of dirt piles where there might possibly be some things. And we were just recently in contact with the State Historical Society to see if they wanted to come and take another look or see if there were things of archaeological significance, because at this point there's quite a bit of much more modern day artifacts like beer cans or something like that around, mixed in with the material that might legitimately be from the early 20th century.
So it sounds like something that, you know, it's news to me. Has it been sort of a well-kept secret over the years?
Well, as I said, again, we don't really want to encourage exploring off the regulation trails, but on the regular sanctioned trails of the Arboretum, it is quite possible to see pavement edges and to see evidence that you're in something that was once going to be a residential development. But it's not, you could also really walk around there for quite a while and not have any idea.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming it's not okay if I want to take the kids and go try to find things and pick them up there, unless it's the beer cans. We're
right.
Welcome to those at that.
Right. It's okay, certainly, to be hiking on the regular trails in daylight hours. But any material that you find, I mean, I guess if it's clearly 21st century trash, that you'd be doing us a favor if you picked up the litter. But if you saw anything that looked like an old piece of pottery or an old bottle of any kind or something, really, you shouldn't be collecting any sort of material in the Arboretum, plant or animal material or anything, without a research permit, because we're a research area and institution. And so if you saw something like that, what we'd appreciate is that you make a note of the location the best you can and notify someone at the Arboretum so we can investigate it.
Surprised you would suggest that, Rob. Very disappointed.
All right. I'll hang my head in shame.
Oh, it's so understandable. We know how intrigued everyone is.
Well, I want to ask you, if this thing had gone forward and there was this giant, you said it was intended to be very grand, city in the Arboretum, would there be an Arboretum today? What would it be like?
Well, there certainly wouldn't be one of anything like the size it is. They planned more than 1,000 lots in this 840 acres. The lot sizes were small by today's standards. They would have been maybe 40 feet by 100 or so feet in size. But they planned in many elegant details. There were central circles with civic and public buildings in them, and every homeowner was to have water access in one way or another through a system of canals, so that if you had a boat, you could get down to the water. There was a 9-hole golf course across Fish Hatchery Road. They planned in many amenities, and it was supposed to be a really lovely place to live, at least according to the propaganda put out by the developers. But for, as we've discussed, a number of reasons, it didn't work out.
And I'm guessing, as an Arboretum guide, you're pretty happy with the way things did ultimately work out.
I won't pretend that I'm sorry that we now have a natural refuge and a green island in the middle of the city instead of more city. But I do understand some of the work that went into the project, and I find it a fascinating history.
Now, are you aware of other lost cities like these existing elsewhere in the country?
Not really. I'm sure there must be. It's like when you go out west looking for a ghost town or something, looking for places where plans were made that didn't quite work out.
All right, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today and introducing us to the Lost City.
Thanks for the invitation. It was great.
That's Kathy Miner. She's a naturalist and guide at the UW Arboretum in Madison. She also helps Stephanie Elkins produce Simply Folk here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I think we might have to have her back next Halloween to hear about maybe ghost stories in the Arboretum. I get the feeling we just sort of scratched the tip of the iceberg there.
And do watch the Arboretum tour schedule for when that tour comes up in 2014.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Well, if there's something you are curious about in Wisconsin, let us know and we can try to get you some information on it. You can call the Central Time hotline. That number is 855-683-5422. 855-683-5422.
Or you can email us, centraltime@wpr.org.
Still to come today on Central Time, our guest explores the rise of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a unique perspective on immigration reform in the United States. Our guest says states should compete to bring in the most immigrants to boost their economies.
First, Rupert Murdoch's media empire spans the globe, including Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, The Times of London, and much, much more. Our next guest traces the rise of that empire and recent scandals that threaten it. David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks guys so much for having me.
Let's jump to the beginning of Rupert Murdoch's media career. What did he learn as an Australian newspaper publisher that led to his incredible international success?
Well, I think he learned a sense, I guess, of the being willfully blind to the restraints that were imposed on him. I mean, here's a guy who basically time and again found ways to push up against the regulations on what he was allowed to invest in, on what he felt were the unfair public subsidies of public broadcasting in Australia, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which ended up being a powerful player, not just in radio, but television, and who in took lessons about that to places like Britain, where it was seen that an Australian-born guy who was a tabloid news editor, he took over the News of the World and the Sun there and turned them from struggling titles into the nation's most popular newspapers, that a guy like that shouldn't be allowed to own two of the nation's most prestigious papers. And he sort of pushed against what people saw as limitations on how many papers one person should own, and he just sort of steamrolled it through. And time and again, he's done the same thing with television holdings, both in the UK and the US. So I guess what he took there was sort of a healthy disdain for the idea that simply because people had limitations in place that he should accept the world as it's been designed and instead tried to conform others the way he thought things should be situated.
And it's not just regulations. In a lot of ways, the customs of media, he thought no longer applied, right?
Well, here's a guy who introduced to the British tabloids, which were already, you know, papers that often like to focus on crime and scandal, but he really upped the ante, making it a much crueler, I think, a much more tougher, at times more punitive sport, both, you know, not only in Australia and the UK, but here in the US with the New York Post. For a time, he owned the Chicago Sun-Times and the Boston Herald as well. And, you know, that tabloid blood is coursing through the veins of Fox News, even if its political stripes are a little more conservative than even his own right-of-center views.
And those tabloids, in all those cases you just mentioned, and on to Fox News, got influence over the national governments in Australia, in the UK, here in the United States. Was that a conscious strategy of Murdoch's?
Yeah, look, he's genuinely a creature of the political right. He is a conservative guy, reflexively in many ways, although his views, as I mentioned, aren't really as conservative as some of the most popular figures on Fox News. But, you know, one of his sources of influence and genius politically in some sense is that he really is willing to throw the support of his newspapers to major figures of both major political parties in all three of these great English-speaking nations. So he'll toggle back between, you know, Democrats of the center-left, like Hillary Clinton running for Senate in 2000 and again in 2006 here in New York State, where, you know, the New York Post supported her. And then to people on the right, you know, Republicans can otherwise get supports. Tony Blair, a figure of the center left, he sort of cast aside some of the Labour Party in the UK's socialist traditions and history to form a more centrist company. And he left John Major and the Conservative Party, Murdoch did, and swung his four newspapers to the side of Blair. And when he thought that Blair's partner, rival, and successor, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, was spent, he then switched his papers over to support the Conservative Party of David Cameron, who's now the Prime Minister. And this accomplishes a couple things. I mean, among other things, it means that both parties kind of have to stay on their toes because both of them have hopes of winning his endorsements. You know, the New York Times is unlikely to endorse a Republican for office anytime soon. The Wall Street Journal is unlikely to endorse a Democrat for presidency anytime soon. And that's a Murdoch publication that's a bit more conservative on its editorial pages than Mr. Murdoch himself is. But these, the tabloid here, the New York Post, and the his newspapers throughout the rest of his English-speaking empire really are willing to toggle back and forth, and that gives him so much more influence than if it was predictably one party or the other.
You mentioned the Wall Street Journal, and at some point he started taking the money that his corporation made from those tabloids and buying prestige papers, the Times of London, Wall Street Journal, and others. Why did he make that jump?
Well, he's always played sort of a two-level game with when it came to newspapers. You know, he makes his money through the tabloids and shapes popular opinion and sort of sets the acceptable realm of discourse for the publication, for the public at large, through his tabloids, which have these big readerships. And then he reaches an elites and shapes, you know, discourse for them through by owning these prestigious papers. So in Australia in 1964, there was no really no general interest newspaper for the country at large. In 64, he created what was called The Australian, which is sort of as though it's the Wall Street Journal if its news pages had more of its opinion interlaced into its coverage. In the UK, he picked up the Times of London and the Sunday Times. And you're right, the Times of London has never made him a dime. You know, The Australian is unprofitable. The Wall Street Journal is barely profitable, but the New York Post, you know, he first bought it in 1977, I believe it was, and he's never made a dime off the Post either. But these papers help him to reach a wide audience and also to reach an audience that is viewed by politicians as their voters. And so he shapes the elite opinion with things like the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, the Australian, and he reaches the public, which these bigger tabloids. But there's one more element. You know, in recent years, even his big circulation papers have seen their revenues really decline. And one of the great values of having this influence at the top levels of government in all three of these major countries is that these are the same guys who make the decisions that can affect Murdoch's highly regulated holdings in, you know, cable television, and in broadcast TV as well, and satellite TV. And as a result, you have people who feel that they owe you favors, who are in position to do you great benefits. And those, until this year when he split the company in two, those broadcasting and entertainment and television revenues really subsidized the losses at places like the Times of London and the New York Post.
When Rupert Murdoch starts or takes over an existing media outlet, how much of a stamp does he personally put on it?
He puts a great deal. You know, he was once asked under oath in England, you know, about what he believed. And he said, anyone who wants to know what I think, you know, is welcome just to read the Sun tabloid every day. And in this country, it would pretty much hold true for the New York Post. It's kind of a anti-elitist, it's right of center, it's brawling, it likes to treat, you know, it likes to cover sports, it likes to treat celebrities as sport, it likes to treat politicians as sport, you know, the inherent assumption that most of them are either philanderers or crooks or both, you know, and it's his belief that behind closed doors people are cheating the everyday people that he alone somehow has a connection to. When he bought the Wall Street Journal, though, you know, the first weeks and months, he was in the newsroom here in Midtown Manhattan, and he, you know, he was looking at headlines. I guess actually initially it was downtown near the old financial center before they moved it up close to our offices here in Midtown Manhattan. But, you know, he would go through and he'd look at headlines and layouts, and suddenly you saw a lot more color photographs. incorporated into the front page and the section fronts. You saw bigger headlines and bolder language used and fewer really long pieces from the front page. And all of that is consistent with what his editors that he brought in, you know, advised, but it was also very consistent with the man himself. And, you know, when it comes to his tabloids, he really talked to those guys on an almost daily basis. You know, it was as though the sun never set on Murdoch's empire. I was told by the former editor and publisher of the New York Post that in the days before email and caller ID on phones, that you know every editor had two phones on his or her desk, and they were almost all men. The first phone would be the phone that your secretary would route all your calls to, and the second phone was like a bat phone that only Rupert, and if you were feeling very brave, maybe your spouse would also have the number too. And that, you know, he would call if it was morning in Sydney, Australia, he would call that phone. If it was morning in London, he'd call the Sun or the News of the World. If it was morning in New York or Chicago or Boston, he'd call those phones. And he was always, every hour available to him awake was an hour to call his tabloid editors and say, you know, Murdoch here, what do you have? What do you know?
We're talking to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about his new book on Rupert Murdoch's media empire. It's called Murdoch's World.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about Rupert Murdoch or thoughts about the impact he's had on media and politics? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation with a look at some of the scandals facing that media empire coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We continue our conversation about Rupert Murdoch and his media empire. Our guest is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. He's the author of Murdoch's World.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Rupert Murdoch has made the media landscape better or worse? What do you think of Fox News and some of his other holdings? 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. David, you start your book with a remarkable moment. Rupert Murdoch meeting the family of a young girl who was missing, later found murdered, and whose cell phone had been hacked into by one of Rupert Murdoch's media outlets. Give us the story behind that scandal.
Well, you know, there had been rumblings in the years leading up to 2011 of various moments and episodes in which people acting on behalf of Rupert Murdoch's tabloid, the News of the World, their journalists and a private investigator or two, had been hacking into the phone of people who were in the news. But the people who were in the news were either involved in professional sports or were celebrities like Sienna Miller, the actress who used to be married to Jude Law, or politicians like the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott. And you know, nobody really took it seriously. There was a sense in British reporting, particularly in the Murdoch press, that these guys were all fair game. And in July 2011, the Guardian revealed that actually this girl, Millie Dowler, 13 years old, who disappeared in 2002 and whose remains were found after her murder 6 months later, and whose disappearance was a national sensation, that her phone had been voraciously hacked into by people acting on behalf of the newspaper. And suddenly people, you know, just ordinary people around Britain who had thought of this as a lark or just as, you know, bad behavior by the rogues at tabloids whom they clucked over but still plunked down a buck to read the reporting of, suddenly they thought this was vile. This was just astonishingly, essentially evil. You know, it was believed at the time, it's now no longer clear, but it was believed at the time that the reporters had also erased voicemail messages on the cell phone of the girl in order to free it up so that additional voicemails could be left so that they could learn more from the girl's friends and other people looking for her and use that for their coverage too. And while it's now not clear that that was actually the case, the family believed that at the time, and they believed that they had been given false hope by the fact that they thought their daughter had been listening to these voicemail messages. So Murdoch, you know, who always feels anti-elites and that he understands the common person, has actually almost never had to confront real-world people, people who are not prominent, people who are not powerful, people who don't know how to deal with the press, but just ordinary, everyday people who have been sucked into the maw of his newspaper's reporting and have felt the pain and the suffering as a result. And in this moment in which the book starts, he's in this extremely posh hotel in a suite on one of the upper level floors where it's just him, the parents of this dead girl, her sister, who have spent nearly a decade trying to come to grips with this. Her killer had been finally convicted only a few months earlier, and he's forced to say to them how sorry he is. Their lawyer says to him, you know, your mother was this great benefactor of Australia and considered a patron saint of Australia. You know, she'd be ashamed of you. And Murdoch looks up at the lawyer and says, my father would be ashamed. And his dad was a very prominent and respected political journalist and later a newspaper executive in Australia. And it's a moment at which, you know, you're thinking about children and parents. You're thinking about a billionaire and the most ordinary everyday people, Bob Dowler, Millie's father, just an IT guy, you know, an anonymous guy who happened to be caught up in a terrible family tragedy and whose daughter's privacy was violated even as her life had been taken, her privacy violated in this instance by people working on Murdoch's behalf. And so it was a real unusual moment of humbling for a billionaire who usually dictated the terms of how he was discussed.
And yet you write that that lawyer representing that family, the one who said your mom would be ashamed of you, also let Murdoch know that he knew that people had been trying to dig up dirt on him to get him to back off on the case.
Yes, in fact, he said in sort of a coded message to Murdoch, you know, I know you know about me, but I know about you as well. Your mother would be ashamed. But the first part of that statement, exactly as you say, was him saying, I know you know about me. And the reason that they knew about him was that they had been following him, and they'd been trying to catch up dirt. Lawyers working on behalf of News Corp in the UK actually made representation to judges saying he's clearly been having an affair with a romantic relationship with another lawyer for these other people who are suing News Corp for hacking, and therefore he is compromised ethically and can't represent them. Well, two things were wrong with that. Well, three things were wrong with that, let's be clear. The first off, it's not 100% clear to me why there would be an ethical issue legally and the lawyers I've talked to if he was having an involvement. Secondly, there's no proof he was having any sort of relationship with her, so it seemed to be an untrue representation. And the third thing was, what the heck were they doing following him? They should be defending their own activities. But the whole notion, the Murdoch empire was built on this notion of, you know, if somebody's coming after you, you punch them harder. And that was represented on their pages. It's represented at times in their PR staffs, and we talked about how they worked at Fox, but they were very combative in England as well at times. And you saw it reflected in the legal stance they took towards those who dared to challenge them. You know, the brilliance of Mark Lewis, who was the lawyer who represented the family of Millie Dowler and many other hacking victims as well, is that he decided at an early point that he would not care about anything they published at him. And if you don't care if people publish gossip or untrue things about you in the tabloid press, you're almost impervious to pain. It's just that most human beings going around and they care whether or not people lie about them. And that's a very different stance to take. He took a very clever stance, and he's emerged a much wealthier man as a result, just relocated to Los Angeles.
One of the big questions as all this was going on was this rogue elements within the News Corporation, or was this, if not directly caused by Rupert Murdoch, caused by the culture he created?
Well, look, right now on trial in London are, among others, two of his former top tabloid editors, Andrew Colson, who was editor-in-chief of the News of the World, and Rebecca Brooks, who was editor-in-chief of News of the World, then editor-in-chief of The Sun, the best-selling newspaper in the UK, and finally the CEO of Rupert Murdoch's British newspaper arm before she was compelled to resign after the Millie Dowler revelations. It should be noted that the Millie Dowler revelations were followed by revelations that not only were there a slew of other celebrities and politicians who were hacked, but that people who were killed in combat in British armed forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, their phones were hacked. People who were blown up in the July 2005 public transit bombings in London, they had their phone hacks. People who were victims of murders and other things. You know, it turned out that Millie Dowler did not appear to be an aberration, but more of the rule, and police developed evidence suggesting that many thousands of people had their phones hacked, you know, some of whom, you know, were not famous and just happened to be caught up in tragic circumstances. So, you know, I think it's important to say Rebecca Brooks has pleaded not guilty to all the charges against her. She's charged with conspiracy to commit hacking. She's also charged with conspiracy to commit corruption, because what they did was pay off police for information, according to prosecutors, that was illegal and needed to be kept private. And she's also been charged with a conspiracy to conceal evidence from prosecutors and from police. you know, Andrew Coulson has also pleaded not guilty to all the charges he's facing, and some other people as well. But a number of people have pleaded guilty to related charges there. And, you know, while I'm not saying a majority of people involved participated, you know, on trial right now are former CEO, former, chief editor of the News of the World, the top-selling Sunday newspaper in the UK, the former head of security for News International, who, is being charged with, among other things, obstruction of justice and concealing evidence. These are very senior people. Rebecca Brooks was essentially a surrogate daughter to Rupert Murdoch, and Murdoch's feeling was, you know, win at all costs. He did say, famously, in 1989, that any service the public was willing to pay for that was within the, achieved within the law was a public service, which is a very different definition than public broadcasting or the New York Times or the Washington Post or, you know, the Guardian might put for what public service truly is. It would appear that even by just what's been proven so far, not even by the trials going on currently, that you could argue that a sizable number of Murdoch's journalists in London dropped the phrase within the law and simply said, you know, whatever the public was willing to pay for was a public service, and they did love reading about crime and about political scandal and about celebrity gossip.
I want to spend a minute on this side of the pond and the influence of Fox News, another big part of the Murdoch empire. How successful has Fox been at driving the American political agenda?
You know, Fox is different than Rupert Murdoch in the sense that it is more conservative in its inclinations, the story threads it picks, the hobby horses it rides, than Murdoch himself. And it also doesn't, you know, unlike his tabloids and the papers in London and Australia, it doesn't toggle back and forth between the two big parties. It sometimes throws Democrats a bone, but basically it is a player in the Republican Party. But what a player it is. I mean, Roger Ailes, who helped run the messaging campaign for then-candidate Richard Nixon in 1968, you know, who helped George H.W. Bush in 1988, who helped run Rudy Giuliani's first and unsuccessful race for mayor in 1989, he basically saw the disappearance of what we used to call the smoke-filled rooms where the big decisions were made for the Republican Party, and it of late decided to make Fox essentially function, its studios function, as that smoke-filled room. So, you know, people have to try out in the Kleeglites of Fox News rather than simply be vetted by people, who used to be the big bankers and money guys. So in 2012, you know, he wasn't enamored of Romney. Murdoch didn't smell him as a winner, and Murdoch likes to back winners. And so, you know, they promoted other candidates periodically. They pulled people like Herman Cain out of oblivion, essentially, to be, you know, daily personalities on there. And sure, other networks featured him too, but it was really at Fox where candidates had to stop by and prove their mettle with the Republican voters. And so, you know, Ailes has turned Fox at times into the umpire and the arbiter of Republican presidential primary politics and the viability for candidates for other major offices. Right. And that's an incredibly strong influence to play in a country this powerful.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
That's David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. His new book is Murdoch's World.
Coming up, our guest wants to change the way we think about immigration reform, set it aside as a national issue, and let states compete for immigrants. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.